I guess today we can discuss the graphs a little bit more, and I'm thinking what to do next, because at this point I'm kind of lost. I don't know what to do next. And well, let's see. So last time we discussed a little bit the graphs. Or the last set of experiments that I did. So we have the sequential workload, and we have the random workload, mainly for Samson device and memorized time. So in I was discussing this with Ariel earlier, when you were talking to me, and at this point we were kind of lost in exactly how to model, or even if there is a model for all the curves that we have. Right? Mm-hmm. So in the case of, we have actually three very different curves. We have the Sandis, which is just line. We have the Memorite, which is a small range in the low band of the response time. And we have the Samson, which has a small band between 1 and 3 milliseconds, and then goes up and down, right, between 1.5 and 20 milliseconds on this. At this point, I don't know if there is a model. I don't know if my model fits the model that I did for Bright fits any of those devices, if we tune it. So that's for now.
So I was thinking about the, you know, since we discussed those curves and we saw that they are so different,
right.
I was thinking that there are a couple of different directions we can explore, and
okay.
Maybe both of them as well.
Okay.
So sure. The first is that we can create not one, but multiple nodes.
Okay.
So one for each type of, let's say, garbage collection mechanism or FTL mapping mechanism. It's just,
okay.
We know that there is no logging in the FTL, then maybe the model looks different than if we know that there is logging. So that is one direction, which
okay.
is multiple models.
Okay.
The second is coarse-grained models, meaning that, first of all, we ignore all the transitory effects, right? Which means the initial startup, we only look at steady state. And we do not try to model absolute performance, but average performance. So,
okay.
So these are the two directions that I thought we could potentially go towards.
So,
and maybe both at the same time. For
okay.
instance, maybe we have an average performance model for a logging-based FTL, which is different than an average performance model for a non-logging-based FTL.
So when you say average model, you mean that at the end of a run, we have the same average response time for both for the real device and for the model?
Yeah, so these are the two directions that came to my mind after our last discussion.
Okay.
And there may be other directions that we can explore as well, but seems like at least these two are a start.
Right. So one thing I was thinking is because at this point I am a little lost in the graphs we have, experiments we have, and so on. Too many. So I was thinking probably also do some kind of summary or try to come up with conclusions of experiments that we have right now, and actually that also can help in other projects. So you know, try to come up with conclusions like when the SST is in this phase and the request size is this wave, and the SST behaves something like this. And,
once again, that may be multiple conclusions depending on the type of SST.
Right.
So we might have to explore this idea that we think for not one, but many models. And I think that is okay, as long as the number of models is, let's say, 2 or 3, or at most 4.
Okay.
And if there is a way to characterize which model should be used, given an SSD, say, okay, this is a SSD which has no logging, and then so use this model. So there is another step before of characterization before using the model. I think that's also okay.
Okay, I see. So can we also do something like, because it seems like there are different layers in the model, right? We have first FTL, then we have the logging mechanism. I don't know if it's related.
I guess they are very related.
They are very related, yeah, but they are very related. I was trying to think in a way to separate this logic in different models, right? And then we develop different instances of the models in the layer, and then combine them somehow to build our final
because it might
model,
be possible. It might be possible that you can have other combinations.
Yes. So like, I don't know, like block mapping with logging, or block mapping with without logging, or multiple logging, I don't know.
I think the crucial step here is to, I think, go into the characterization direction that you mentioned. And a good starting point for that, I mean, on top of the experiments that Lewis has made, is the thickmetric paper, which pretty much summarizes what the effect of the changing some components, I mean, some conditions, I should say, in the workload has in the real devices. That's for example, for reads. There are very interesting insights, like, for example, the prefetch effect, that it seems that some SSDs implement that feature. Then there's the write buffer as well. That with and without, you see different effects. In the past meetings, while you were away, we concluded that all of our devices that we are testing have no cache at all, or have, I mean, very small cache of like very few pages, let's say below 10 probably. Or maybe Memorize has in the order of 30 something or 20 something. So in characterizing those devices, I think it's important to identify those components that make this huge difference. For example, the Intel device, which has the write buffer, basically does not the response time curve does not change dramatically in the presence of run and write, because everything is mostly absorbed by the cache, and then happens everything in the background. Whereas in the other device, where there's no cache at all, and then you see like there's an increase in the response time as you go through because of this cleaning mechanism and so forth. And later, I mean, I think it's a good direction to, after we characterize and identify, I mean, what those critical components are and how they are possibly implemented in the device, to try these combinations with login, without, with cache, with the write buffer, without the prefetching, and without. And probably we'll be able to combine everything in a single function, per se, to come up with the generalized model.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of our initial objective.
Mm.
So I would suggest definitely to go over that big metrics paper. Once again, I mean, we did the exercise while we were away, but not focused necessarily on characterizing those devices and identifying those key components.
Yeah, I certainly see value in reading the paper a couple of times more. And I sort of like the approach where we can, let's say, create sub-models for which we can use to compose the final model of a certain device. Say, okay, if there is a write buffer, then add this component of the sub-model to the final model. If there is a logging-based approach, add this sub-component or modify this. This term has to look this way. I think that's nice. That would be really good to have. One concern I have is whether we have all the possibilities in the devices that we currently have in the lab. Do we have a device which does not have a write buffer and has logging mechanism? Do we have all those possibilities or not, so we can separate out all these different effects? If we do, that's one stage that we cross. But beyond that, we also need to know which device has what. I mean, identifying whether a device has a write buffer or not itself is a challenge unless that information is available publicly. Or identify what type of FTL a certain SSD is using is also a challenge. In fact, that requires its own characterization, like I said before. Can we do some characterization to determine if an FTL is using logging or not using logging? Right, things of that kind.
Some of those questions are answered in the Sigmatic paper, in particular the write buffer one. Which is, I mean, like you said, I mean, it seems that the response time is not increased dramatically as the workload gets, I mean, more random. Again, I think we should discuss that paper once again. I mean, focus on those.
Right. Then you might also want to think about the following, which is, if I have write buffer size and here I have variability of random write response times. So it could be that when I have a really large write buffer size, then the variability is really small. On the other hand, if I have a small buffer size, the variability keeps going. So we could have a curve, actually, which looks like this. And then it's not a simple question of, do I have write buffer, and in which case I should have this response time variability? If I don't have, and then if I do have, in fact, I have an entire spectrum of performance that lies in between, and I have some fixed size write buffer. So it does become complex. If we can split it into two levels, write buffer, no write buffer, and you have a certain variability versus a different variability, I think that becomes simple, but I don't know if it's possible or not. But yeah, I think the general approach of creating sub-models and, you know, creating a model by just plugging different, terms that these sub-models describe, it sounds really attractive. I'm not sure if it's possible, given the number of devices we have. Maybe we need a lot more devices to actually create all the possible sub-models. So we have, what, four devices now, or three devices that you're experimenting with?
Three.
The MemoWrite, the SanDisk, and the Samsung.
Right.
And we are getting two Intel devices.
Right. We are?
Yeah, so Martha is... I think
managing that.
Yeah, she's managing that. She's placing the order. And this reminds me, I should check with her what's the status of the order. But we are getting two Intel devices, right? I don't know what is the difference between that. One was SLC and the other is MLC.
Okay. So the areas, one is for server side and also Delta side. Because I think the MLC is bigger but slower.
Yeah.
It's something like the difference between SCSI drives and non-SCSI drives.
Yeah. And I was also reading about this MTD.
Right.
And UBI over the weekend. And seems like you need very specific hardware to actually use those. You need raw flash.
Yes.
You need raw flash chips, which can be connected to the motherboard somehow.
Right.
I don't know through what interface. Right. And
it's usually on board.
Yeah.
No. In the case of a laptop, it's this MCI, but I think it's mostly, this MCI stack is mostly used for embedded systems. When you have a small device and you have flash on board that you can access.
No, I see that it's, in the future it might be possible to actually have these flash on the motherboard, even on servers.
Yeah.
So it might so happen. And we are talking about NAND flash, right?
Yeah.
NOR flash, I was reading about NOR flash. It allows the byte addressability can be referenced directly from the CPU.
Right. Yeah.
But there are two drawbacks. One is that it's much more expensive. And second is that the erase cost is substantially higher.
And also the write cost.
The write cost, I think, is actually better if you look at it from a byte. If you're writing bytes, NOR.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is that
it's much faster than if you write bytes.
Is that what I read is that for NAND flash, it's better if you write big.
Yeah. If you're writing large chunks.
Large chunks.
If you change, if the locality of writes is high, that means that you write to very nearby locations in the flash memory, then the NAND write is performs much better. But if it is, the locality is low, then the NOR flash will perform much better.
But I also read that the NOR flash is usually used for executable code.
Yes, that's true. Actually, so let me correct myself. I think writing is fast only if you have already erased the block.
Mm-hmm.
Or in case of NOR, the block sizes are not that big. In fact, they are 32K, 16K, and at most 64K. But even to erase that 16K of NOR flash, it takes half a second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's really slow erase. And I think with NOR flash, you can write more than once. You can write two or three times before you need to erase.
Mm-hmm.
So there's very interesting stuff there. But in general, I think NAND flash is going to be the one that that we need to be more concerned about for cost primarily, and second for erase performance. If you're talking about read-write workload, then NOR is not very good because you cannot erase fast. Any case, that was a digression, so we should come back to what we were discussing. So I think the two directions of creating some models or creating model per device type, I think both are okay. I think creating a model per device type that combines the effects of write buffer, logging mechanism, all the FTL things, is probably going to be easier, especially if you're looking at average case performance,
right,
than to create sub-models for different...
But the question is, if we create one model per device, is that useful at all?
Not device. What I mean is that one model per type of SSD.
Okay.
For instance, whether the SSD has a write buffer, whether it has block level mapping or page level mapping, whether
but
it has
even,
login.
Even in that case, we need to do profiling, right? In the sense that in that case, we need to find which devices have, for instance, write buffer or not. So I'm thinking that probably it's difficult, it's equally difficult in both cases, right?
That's true. That characterization is required for both approaches, right? Whether the device has write buffer or not, even to create submodels, you need to characterize. I think in creating these submodels for each different aspect of the overall model requires further fine-grained separation to say, okay, I need to profile a device which has a write buffer but no logging.
Right.
I need a device which has a write buffer but with logging. My question is, we need to have those many device combinations,
right,
if we need to characterize all these different and come up with individual submodels.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that seems harder than coming up with submodels for the device types that we have in-house. The second kind of characterizations with the submodel, certainly more attractive and generic. My concern is, is it feasible, given the devices that we have?
Yeah, I don't know, but we can give it a thought, yeah. Try and see if we can do that.
The other thing which I said was, we can ignore things like transitory effects. So, in this case, when the SSD is warming up, when the write buffer is getting initially filled up, we ignore that performance.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, those sort of minute granularity of differences may be relevant for a very small fraction of the application. Overall, the applications might just look at average write performance if it's random write versus sequential write. Given that an SSD has a certain write buffer and a certain logging mechanism, or a FTL mechanism. So I think the contribution of our work beyond the Sigmetrics work could be that we identify performance characteristics for different types of SSDs which have different properties. Not to say that, well, for a specific device model and make, but if it's a class of SSDs with certain properties, we can characterize them with a certain model, and if it's a different class, we have a different model.
Okay.
I mean, I would certainly encourage you to look at steady state performance just to make things simple to begin with, and then look at things like, okay, for the first 23 pages, it's really low, and then it starts varying in a band, and as long as it stays in the band for a long time, and then maybe there are intermittent peaks,
mm-hmm.
just focus on the steady state performance. That will make things much easier.
But in that case, we also need to find some kind of time to become like clean again, to be stable again, in the sense that if I do continuous writes, I will have this band, right, of response times, but after I stop for, let's say, 10 seconds, I will start again, right? So I don't know if I have to take into account that time to be a stable again or not.
So one thing, well, we could characterize that as well. For instance, we could say that performance versus load. So what kind of average case performance do you get when you have a certain load on the SSD? What I mean by that is, what is the requested throughput versus what is the observed throughput?
Mm-hmm.
So if I request only, let's say, 10 kilobytes per second at a regular periodic intervals of, you know, each request being 4K, let's say 8 kilobytes per second, then I make 2 requests per second, each of 4 kilobytes. Then I get a certain performance in terms of response time. If I make 8 megabytes per second, which means 2000 requests per second of 4K,
mm-hmm.
then the latency looks like this. So that could be one curve which might be interesting. And we are looking at D2C latency here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if we that would be, an interesting graph to learn from. So if I know what my workload looks like, where on the x-axis it lies, then I know the corresponding latency. Right? So it may be something like this, maybe something like this, who knows? Maybe something like this, and it might actually depend on the device type. So on the x-axis I have load,
in terms of requests per second.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then on the y-axis I have latency, whatever you want to.
That would be like an average.
Average latency.
What's the request?
Average.
Mm-hmm.
Might be interesting.
Yeah.
Because what we are weighing is the periodicity, right? How quickly the requests are coming in. How much time does the garbage collector have if it uses some sort of idle time cleaning?
Mm.
So that might be an interesting graph to learn from. Is that possible to do? I mean, is that straightforward to...
Yeah, I'm trying to think because there are two cases. I see two cases. You can let's say that you send 4 requests in 1 second, right? Or in 10 seconds, let's say. So these 4 requests should be equally spaced. That's one possibility. Or should have random space between them.
In time,
right? What I'm saying. The other thing is that those requests should be sequential to each other in the LDA phase, or should be random?
In both cases, right? You have to look at, I think the biggest difference in performance comes from the access pattern, is sequential versus random.
Right.
And we will have to characterize both separately. Depending on the access pattern, what kind of performance you're going to get. So in this case, I think to keep things simple, first of all, you might want to look at equally separated in time. So you don't have random latencies. Just have equal amount of latency. And second, you want to characterize these two separate sequentially. I think so far the level of detail that people have been looking at least for the Figmatrix paper, is that low end, medium, and high end, without really talking about a class of the devices which have certain properties. Because some devices may be between low and medium, other devices may be between medium and high.
Mm-hmm.
By coming up with this sort of taxonomy of classes of devices, I think we can make a contribution. And then we can also show, okay, we have mechanism to characterize which class this device, any device belongs to. And then if it belongs to a certain class, well, then you have a model towards it. The graph, then maybe we can take a look at. These are for the three devices.
Yeah, I have the graph.
The random.
Sorry, by the way, I leave the experiments for multiple streams.
Mm.
Right. So it turns out that in the case of a memorite, memorite is always the odd device. No, so. Turns out that it works. I mean, if you have six different strings, six different sequential strings, from which you pick, you do round robin, okay, is exactly the same, or at least it has exactly the same throughput than having a sequential workload, like totally sequential workload. So it's exactly the same. But if you go one step further, 7 is completely bad.
Yeah. So you mean it's equal to random?
It's equal to random.
That makes sense. I think it's the same thing with disk drives.
Yes. In the case of Samsung, it goes down greatly. It starts. I don't remember very well. I think it was with four streams. No, it goes down. You have the sequential. The sequential workload, and then you go down and to that one. It's not, I have the sudden drop.
See, this is another experiment which we can use to characterize models for throughput with multiple sequential streams.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we can answer an interesting question based on this experiment. So we have again different device types that. One of the properties of a device type is how does it handle multiple sequential streams.
Mm-hmm.
And the SanDisk, what does that do?
No, I didn't check the SanDisk. I didn't check the SanDisk. I don't know how that would be.
And these experiments that you have graphs for, are they long-running experiments?
Do you
think that you have reached steady state in those?
Yeah, it's usually 10,000 requests. It's not very long. I guess a few 10,000 requests of 4K is not a lot, right? But at least you stress the cleaning, I guess. Probably not.
10,000 requests of 4K is 40 megabytes?
Right.
Depends on what is the size of the reserved logging space. If the number of log blocks is greater than, or the capacity of the log blocks is greater than 40 megabytes, then maybe you have not reached some sort of state where you have continuous cleaning.
Or here is the graph. So what graph do I have in there?
The sequential and random.
Okay.
Writes for the three devices. Let's see.
Okay. So let's start with memory. So we have. So this is the case of Memorite. The green is sequential,
mm-hmm.
and the red is random.
The units are milliseconds on the wire?
Milliseconds.
And you have 2,000 requests?
No, I have more, but I just put in the first 2,000.
Okay.
The rest looks mostly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And plot the rest, so I have
system.
Can you do log scale on Y? See, we can see what's going on with the read. Or do the read and write separately.
This case I have only
100,000 for writes.
100,000 for random. No, this is all writes.
Sequential and random?
Sequential and random writes. So I did only 10,000 for the sequential writes and 100,000 for the random writes.
So the values over there are for the sequential are 200 microseconds. So
which one? This one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is sequential. So it's more or less here. If we go here, is 100 microseconds, more or less. Here you have not much. 140 microseconds is the maximum for the random. The sequential write. In the case of the random write, the maximum is 28, 17, 16. This is random 4K, right?
And this is which device? Memorite?
Memorite.
How about the other two?
On this same graph, just before you switch,
sure.
I mean, the sequential has been observed by the cache clearly in this case. Right?
Seems to be the case.
Like, very little time, 150 or 140 milliseconds at most.
Yeah, to
but
me, it might be possible that you have, for instance, you did not do more than 10,000, right? You did 10,000.
10,000.
That is 40 megabytes.
40 megabytes.
If there are, if the size of the log blocks is greater than 40 megabytes, it could be possible that the state of the log blocks was clean to begin with, and then you could just write these out, even
mm-hmm.
the sequential streams, without having to erase it all.
Mm-hmm.
And that might favor the sequential throughput. So my question is, what if you wrote
more than that? Like 100,000 or more.
400 megabytes.
I think if even in the case when you have all your log blocks free,
mm-hmm.
just writing one page of 4K is going to take more than 140 microseconds. If you actually
That's
write
true.
In the medium. So this response time seems to be only possible if you have a cache that's large enough to call this 4K request. At least it may be a way to validate where you are in the presence of a cache or not, is just to increase this request size. Like, let's say, from 4K to, progressively increase this to 8, 16, 32, till the moment that you don't have this nice performance anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Basically repeat this experiment with larger write requests.
That's certainly one possibility. What would happen if you increase the size of that request is that it still continue to be absorbed in the write buffer, but will be in the background probably written to medium, right? this, I guess the same thing is happening in this case. And as you write in the background to the medium, you free up the write buffer to absorb more requests. So the rate at which the requests are coming in and the rate at which the requests are being flushed is the key question here. Are we able to send requests fast enough so that the write buffer is already full when the request comes in?
So that the flush hasn't happened yet when
the flush
next request comes into the
correct
account?
Because it could be very much possible in this case that the rate at which the requests are coming in is not fast enough to overwhelm the write buffer. Because we are only measuring D2C latencies here. And D2C latencies, I agree, those latencies are probably a consequence of just buffering and then reporting as complete, which is what the disk drives also do, and the SSDs will also do. But in the background, these requests are being flushed continuously, and there is continuous space being created in the write buffer, as a consequence of which we see these continuous low latencies. So what might happen is that even if we do a large number of requests, we continue to see the same latencies if we issue the request at the same rate, at a low rate.
But I'm sending the request as fast, fast as I can, yeah.
That's true.
And in this case, it says that the average C2D, right, which is the time between, is... microseconds, 36 nanoseconds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's very small.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Could it be possible that the low latency...
Wait a second. This is second. No, this is 36 microseconds.
36 microseconds.
That
does make a difference, because it's almost 20-25% of the latency that we see there.
That makes a difference?
Because that's approaching the actual latency that takes to write into the flash cell, which is in the order of 200 microseconds.
Okay.
Like that's... it should be the time that the device is busy, and then if you make request arrive within that time frame, that it may suffer in terms of performance. That's what we want to kind of overwhelm this.
Yeah, but even with this at this rate, first of all, if that is the case, then there is no way for an operating system to pull out the write buffer, right? Because the operating system cannot go faster than this.
No, but Ariel had a solution to that. Use larger requests, then you fill up more of the write buffer with each request.
Right. But even in this case, eventually we will pull out the write buffer, right?
Not necessarily. If the rate at which the requests or pages are coming into the write buffer is equal to or greater or smaller than the rate at which they are leaving the write buffer, we will never flood the write buffer.
They are leaving the write buffer. Because they can be written in
files? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it would be good to try out with larger request sizes. And even with larger number of sequential, because we don't know which situation it is. It could be, for instance, that the latencies are small just because of the nature of memorite. Maybe just does very fast writes. It does very fast writes within 100 microseconds per page. Who knows? Then we will observe these latencies as long as there are clean blocks. And then if you run out of clean blocks and start erasing, then the situation changes.
What about this? So one way is to send big requests, right? But I would think you probably send really, really big requests, like 60 megabytes requests. And in that case, we're sure that probably, you know, I'm guessing that if you send one 60 megabyte request, then you will log the byte buffer in the first request.
Well, in that case, it might not even be buffered. It will be buffered, I guess, only partially, maybe. Depends on the size of the write buffer.
Okay.
That might have some other issues. For instance, it might lead to switch merges instead of full merges and things like that. And that might give a different impression of the sequential write buffer.
That's true. Yeah. Even parallelism will start to take place in this large chunk.
Yeah, but even with the small bytes, you will have switch merge, right? So I don't see a problem with switch merge.
Well, as long as it happens in the background and your cache is still able to absorb the next request, you will now notice that. Now, going just back about the last point you mentioned, that the memorized might as well be writing pretty fast, like in the order of 100 microseconds or less. Probably that's less likely because we know that it's a Samsung Plus chip. And we know the latencies for that is being 200 microseconds at least.
Okay.
So,
that's a good point.
Yeah, that may reinforce the idea of being a cache absorbing thing.
If it's 200 microseconds, then our average latency is C to D plus D to C is 200 microseconds, then what it's telling us is that the rate at the buffer is getting populated is also the rate at which it's being depleted, and that's why we see low latencies here, the D to C latency. So we should look at average D to C plus C to D and look at what number that is. And I believe it's close to 200 microseconds, right? Depending on your based on your number.
Let me see. It's average D2C per IO is obviously milliseconds. Okay, it's 100 microseconds, and the C2D is 36 microseconds. So it's
1.6.
That's lower than 200 microseconds, unless it's some new flash chip, or it's a new generation flash chip which does faster, right?
But we have the data sheet.
We have the data sheet?
Yeah.
It's pretty much the same.
Yes.
In terms of the latencies for reads and writes.
Uh-huh.
For those exact flash chips inside the memory?
We still haven't taken the features.
I have to
Might be good to share maybe in your URL address.
It's in the URL.
It's in the wiki?
No, it's not in the wiki. It's your profile
page.
So if you go to the pictures, then you have memory 1 and memory 2.
There are two memorites?
No, it's in the front and back.
So they are attached on both sides.
There are 8 chips in there.
Yeah, and the other side is 3 more.
And yeah, you see the model with
the
original
model. This one.
We could also look at the RAM on that guy and see how big it is.
This is the RAM.
Yeah. Can we find out how big it is?
I looked for a data sheet for the RAM, but I think I couldn't read the oh yeah, that was the problem. I couldn't read them all from the picture, so I need to open it up again.
even if you blow it up, you cannot see it. I think you can read it.
Five. At this number, what number is this?
And that could be six, or three. Either, I think it's six.
And this number here?
That's S.
No, the one before. K4.
K4, yeah.
K4, S, 5, 8.
6. Yeah, oh, 8. Yeah, it could also be 8. 8, 1, 6, 3, 2, 1. H. UC60. I think you can find. You can try different possibilities.
I tried that. And I couldn't find. Actually, I found. I couldn't find the exact data sheet for this memory, but I found some similar. I said it was RAM.
Okay. How big is it?
I didn't see how big it is because it was different. So it's not exactly this one. So for it to be bigger, it could be smaller. So I don't know. That's why I know this is RAM.
Then we have an idea of how big a write buffer is.
Well, you can also the picture in that screen.
What is that? K4?
K4 S.
64?
Is it 5, 8?
5, 8 or 6 or 3. Looks like a...
1, 6, 3, 2.
Probably it's 8, yeah. 1, 6, 3, 2.
5, 8, 1, 6, 3, 2, H.
H.
H. UC 60.
Okay. K4.
But you can find the suggestions of Google. Right?
Yeah. K4 what?
K4S.
S.
It's still
for sure.
I have K4S64.
Yeah, the next might be 6, but looks like a 5.
6416.
3, 2. 641632. Yeah, the last 62 are okay.
Which one is it?
UP60H.
Is that right? It's not the same.
What?
It's not the same, right?
K4S64.
This is not 64, this looks like a 5-8. And it looks different as well.
One megabyte 16-bit. If they're all the same, then maybe...
I was thinking that also another possibility, another direction is instead of doing a model, more like a profiling thing. So now that we have the block size and the page count, probably with some experiments we can try to find the mapping or something else. The mapping, actually we can use that in our batch for the experiments. To find the logging mechanism and so on. I don't know. I mean, I was trying to say that we have also that that information we can use.
Yeah.
Sorry, just one quick. I should be running back in. But you can't continue that. I think catch up there.
Okay. All right, I guess that's fine. I think what we should do next is to try to characterize the write buffer with something like you know, what we were doing here with the sequential writes, but maybe run the sequential write experiment for longer to see if that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And also with larger request sizes, see if that makes a
difference.
If we can get average latencies for the random write and the sequential write based on the request load, I think that would help as well. I'm not sure if the sequential write would change a whole lot with the request load. Maybe it will be a flat line.
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
I don't think it's a flat line.
Should we also discuss the those experiments? I mean, in this same aspect of the SSD across the paper, so we can compare our results with what they found.
Yeah, let's do that as well. I think it might be a good idea to look at the results of the symmetric paper, compare those against ours.
There are like a couple of experiments that involve random writes.
But it helps mostly all the experiments. I mean, it's just a matter of plot the right forces. I have random, sequential, and I don't think we need more than that.
I think that's good enough, and you might want to look at whether you have steady state numbers or not. That is one thing you might want to reevaluate.
Okay.
Just pick one experiment and do that for a longer period of time to see if there is any performance difference.
Okay.
And if it is representative, then that's good enough. But if it's not, then we might have to do something else. And when you do this request per second plot, the load versus latency plot, again, you need to somehow push the system into steady state and run the experiment for longer. I think from what I have read in a couple of places, SSDs are sometimes provisioned with even 5% additional log blocks of the capacity of the SSD. So if you have a 32 gigabyte SSD, then the log blocks can be, how much is that? It's 16 megabytes, right? No. 32.
Is it 5% or 32?
160 megabytes. So that's a lot. And if all those are clean when you start your experiment, then maybe for sequential writes, you will not encounter cleaning at all until you write so much data. So those are the things to keep in mind. There are a large number of log blocks there.
Mm-hmm.
If anything is possible, we don't know what are the internal characteristics yet. Okay, so when should we meet next? Next Monday or Thursday?
I will try to have experiments for this Thursday.
Okay.
If I don't have it, you can next Monday.
Okay, you let us know.
Yeah.
Mine will be Friday, or it's not the day for you?
Friday is not good because there is no air conditioning on the third floor on
there
Friday.
You know. Oh, yeah. I was thinking of Professor Jason because I know that he's more available on Friday.
On Friday?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, his lab, his office does not have that problem.
But
because it's on the second floor.
Be back by then.
You can also meet in his lab.
We will choose the two, I think.
Yeah, but physically...
It starts this Friday.
It does?
Yeah, it's 19.
Yeah.
19.
Yeah, it starts.
If it's Friday, definitely on the second floor.
Yeah. We meet on the second floor, but usually I want to have as many meetings as possible on the day I'm here.
Right.
So I would prefer Thursday, if we can meet on Thursday.
I will send an email. I guess if he cannot do it, he will send.
Right, gentlemen.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Thanks.
Bye.